Hello, everyone. It's an honor to be talking to you all tonight. This fall, I was honored to be chosen for an advanced fellowship with the Office of Student Research. This fellowship allowed me to engage in this process of creative inquiry that we all talk about, and it was in an area of musical repertoire that, as a classical singer, I rarely get to engage with. Because vocal performance degrees are largely focused on art song, oratorio, and opera repertoire, cabaret is left unexplored. And that is what my project is on. So based upon my research, I crafted a concert program, and it was called The Wild Stage. And this concert was meant to engage audiences with this cabaret repertoire. And prior to the pandemic, this program that I was directing and six of my colleagues were singing for was scheduled for April 4th. So we really hope to perform this program at some point in the future. And I would love to keep everyone on board and in the loop for any future performances. So I'd actually like to call your attention to an Instagram page that we started. It's called At The Wild Stage, and you can receive any updates on the program or how we're engaging with this area of repertoire. On that page, I am conducting interviews with the cast. I'm going live every few days to talk about cabaret, and it's going to have a lot of information on the genre on there. We're hoping to put some musical performances on there. So please give us a follow. Again, that's At The Wild Stage. So in this lecture, first, I'd like to talk about what is cabaret, its evolution, why we're engaging with it, and what its value is. So I'm going to start with, what is it? So I'd like to point out, first of all, that cabaret is in fact the German word for cabaret. But when I refer to cabaret, I'm only talking about the German version of this genre. So much like opera, cabaret is a genre that fuses different artistic mediums. In cabaret, there is poetry, dance, song, and theater. What's unique about cabaret, though, is that it formats these mediums into vignettes or numbers. So each song, sketch, or dance is its own scene. And concerts or programs, as I'll probably refer to them from here on, may allow characters to reappear, but one scene really doesn't need to bear any reference to another scene. And this genre had a really interesting evolution, so I'd like to cover that first. So, German cabaret was largely inspired by their Parisian neighbors in Montmartre, who originated this genre some 30 years prior as the cabaret that we all know. However, German cabaret really goes on in its own origins and then goes on to have its own unique separate evolution. In 1900, Otto Julius Bierbaum published Deutsche Chansons, and he referred to this collection as singable poetry. So what does that mean, right? It was just text. It wasn't song. It wasn't drama. And this collection included poems by Frank Wedekind and Ernst von Wolzogen. But Bierbaum's aim was really to establish this German collection of poetry, and he said he wanted it to warrant a performance. So that means that these poems could easily be paired with songs and music, or they could be acted out as a stage monologue. And Bierbaum is really noted for saying, applied lyric, that is our battle cry. So that gives you an idea of the kind of text that he wanted to be included in theater. And he also thought traditional formats of theater, where audiences watch, you know, one story unfold for hours, was totally outdated. And he said that the modern city man has variety nerves. So in other words, programs should include a variety of stories and messages delivered in different mediums in order to capture the imagination of a modern audience. And he believed that the poetry and messaging should reflect contemporary quandaries, things that everyday people were dealing with every day. And the content and delivery of such poetry and messaging should be accessible, but it was always striving for this artistic and intellectual integrity. So it was really a balancing act from the very beginning. And Baronist Ernst von Wolzogen, so if you remember, he was a poet for Deutsche Chansons, went on to found the very first cabaret stage. And Wolzogen admired the French cabarets so much that he wanted to create a German version. Again, they are the inspiration. In 1901, the Überbrettl had its premier program. This is a stage. And it wasn't a seemingly traditional theater, but it was a much smaller stage. This is what they call Kleinkunst, although the seating and the venue sat as much as a traditional theater. And programs were not prudish, nor were they deliberately erotic, but they didn't yield to public taste or any political party agendas. However, the Wilhelmine monarch in Germany really did enforce strict censorship over the theater. And Wolzogen is noted for saying that he had to renounce the most important activity of the French cabaret, namely its topical political satire. So this was really the starting point for cabaret. It included variety. It didn't get to the societal function as much in the early days. In the Wild Stage, which is our program, I chose to present one of the sung selections from the premiere of the Überbrettl, and it's called Tanzlied by Bogumil Zeppler. And I'm going to talk about that piece in great detail in the second presentation when I actually dive in to how we crafted our program and five selections actually that are in it, and I'll describe how I staged them and give you really an inside look into my process as a director. So after the variety theaters came the literary cabarets. And censorship ended in 1918 when the Wilhelmine monarchy fell. And this resulted in a lot of explicit and erotic entertainment, and it really began to be commonplace for this stuff to be happening in Berlin nightclubs. So in opposition to this body entertainment that was really pervading culture, stages, literary cabarets began to take on more political, satirical, and social subjects. That's how the literary cabaret was born, truly. And artists that were established opened small stages without dancing or an expensive overhead. So they truly were not moneyed endeavors. They were not nightclubs in any sense of the word. They were theatrical venues that were meant to have almost a casual vibe, if you will. And many artists really saw these small stages as a place to really experiment to their artistic height without a lot of concerns about money, truly. So Max Reinhardt was an actor and teacher, and he opened a cabaret called the Schall und Rauch, or the Smoke and Noise in English, in a small beer cellar. And initially the stage was a financial and artistic success. Friedrich Hollander was the house composer for the stage, and there were a lot of well-known performers that performed at this stage. We have Paul Gretz performing here, even at the premiere, and Nita Berber. We have Mady Christians later on. And Paul Gretz and Mady Christians went on to have big film careers, which is like really exciting that we got to see them early on at the Schall und Rauch, or the Schall und Rauch got to see them, rather. And the Schall und Rauch, although it closed after just two seasons, because we had all these amazing, prominent artists coming together to truly create art, it really provided a wealth of really unique and innovative repertoire. So for a program, I programmed a number of selections from the Schall und Rauch premiere. The political couplet, Wende Automotivita Takt, provides a direct comment on the political climate of the Weimar Republic. And then we also programmed the melancholy chanson, Abschied von der Bohème, and that makes a nostalgic and sentimental comment that seems to foreshadow the demise of Dadaism as a popular philosophical movement in theater. So we have these two songs on the premiere. They are diametrically different. We have one about the political strife of the common man in Berlin, and we have one about a philosophical movement in theater and a nostalgic sentiment. So they're very different, and we can already see in this way that the element of variety is really being preserved in this literary cabaret. And another stage I find worth mentioning is Trude Hesperich's Die Wilde Bühne, or the Wild Stage, for which our program is named. And while I couldn't uncover any repertoire from the Wild Stage, the spirit of Hesterberg's stage was something I tried to implement into my direction. So what's interesting is that Hesterberg was an established operatic soubrette, and she was clearly classically trained in music and theater. And her contemporaries always noted that De Vildebuno was oriented towards goals of audience outreach and artistry. Hestberg directed each song instead of enlisting each individual artist to create their own blocking. And her direction implemented a lot of visual elements and set pieces to aid the audience in really understanding the material. So even if it was didactic in her manner of explaining, she thought at least they understand it. She thought that the reason a lot of literary cabarets weren't doing so well was because the audiences weren't grasping the material. And she really took on that responsibility and said, you know, it's probably our fault that they're not understanding the material. So although our set is minimal at the Wild Stage, I did include a lot of prop pieces and tried to make much of the dialogue that I wrote on my own plain speak so as to allow the material to be understood, because we're already performing these selections in German. So after the mid-1920s, literary cabarets were kind of being abandoned for this new theatrical form called revue. And revue retained elements of satire, political commentary, and theatrical variety. So you say, what's the problem? Revue was cabaret on a much grander scale, though. So venues were larger, and budgets were often provided by these moneyed producers. So with the advent of revue and cabaret's new money, many critics complained that some of the composers and poets were now playing it safe or diluting the controversy, although it was still there. But the main thing that we lose with revue and its evolution to revue is intimacy. Audiences and venues were simply too large. But we get a positive from revue because artists were provided with a lot more opportunities because of the massive scale that revue was on. So Hollander, the house composer for the Schall und Rauch, was now able to write for jazz bands to accompany singers instead of just a keyboardist. And performers were also able to reach larger audiences and boost their own popularity. In our program, we've included Hollander's Rauch mit den Männern, or Check Out All the Men, and it was originally performed by Claire Waldoff. And although this song is really humorous in nature, her performance really solidified her as an icon of female strength. So, while quite a lot of music, theater, and writing falls underneath this umbrella of cabaret, the material is really similar in a few central ways. Cabaret programs almost always aim to deliver three things to an audience. That first being variety, inform a narrative, contradiction of societal norms, and three, a fusion of the intellectual and the entertaining. Because these balances are particularly difficult to strike, cabaret evolved quickly. That's why we saw this quick evolution, because it was difficult to maintain these balances. Rarely did critics feel that those stages were actually truly successful in accomplishing this ideal of the genre, because the ideal of the genre was this balance again. While I've already spoken a bit about variety, I would like to discuss why variety theater seemed to be appealing to artists, producers, and audiences. So, variety, but why variety? First of all, the rehearsal process, I would like to say, for small scenes, especially if they don't, you know, bear any correlation to one another, is different than in traditional theater. When you have a small scene, it really offers a lot more opportunities for actors to bring minute details and specificity to their performance. Because in short scenes and numbers, there also are not any long-standing character conventions and no previously established character contexts, performers are really free to unleash their creativity. You know, they haven't seen 1,000 other people's Hamlets before, because these scenes are, first of all, this genre is a little bit more obscure, but also because they're smaller scenes. And as a result, performers, especially back then, drew inward to present more parts of themselves. So we have somebody like Mady Christians, who was a film actress, again, like I said, who sang in the Schall und Rauch. She often delivered songs that reflected her own personality, even if the narrative was slightly different. So because of this, audiences would invest even further in the performers, because they were seeing glimpses of persona, which audiences would get attached to. So the second aspect of cabaret, and perhaps the most hotly contentious, is its societal function. So throughout my research, I really did read a variety of scholarly perspectives that range from equating satire to cabaret simply as a genre of contradiction. And, you know, I really did find myself aligning with the latter. While cabaret really does include satirical forms in many stages, especially south of Berlin and Vienna, were actually aligned with satirical newspapers in practice, and especially where cabaret really found its groove in Berlin, it just wasn't actually full of satire. Rather, as scholar Alan Leroux says, satire was a tool that cabaret used in the mixture of small theatrical forms. And then we have someone like scholar Jürgen Henningsen saying about cabaret that it cites travesty, parody, caricature, and unmasking by means of deception, omission, abstraction, stylization, and plays on language. The theme of the cabaret is the gaps and contradictions in the audience's experiences and values. So obviously there's a whole lot more at play than simply satire. Cabaret is really a genre that unveils these audience perceptions and then contradicts them. The key word is contradicts. Cabaret is all about the controversy. So poets that were writing for the cabaret often included comments on particularly topical or current events. Same with cabaret. The audiences could have immediately related to these references. However, the material was crafted and delivered in a manner that maintained its artistic integrity and depth. So cabaret artists were often people that wanted to improve the quality of popular entertainment and reach everyday people. So in our program, we included a piece by Friedrich Hollander and Kurt Tucholsky, which is called Zieh dich aus, Petronella, or Take It Off, Petronella. And this piece was really meant to reference the pornography that was going on in popular entertainment that was touted as intellectual. They would say it's Hellenic when anytime they would be, you know, censored or anything like that. So we find great humor, and audiences find great humor in this song, but it's actually quite a intellectual statement on art. Other selections that we've included in our program strike really similar balances. The sketch, The Lady is a Tramp, details this riveting personal drama. You are on the edge of your seat where this story is going to go in this monologue, but it also simultaneously makes this powerful comment of women's rights in Wilhelmine, Germany. So these messages are delivered immediately and quickly in small forms, and then the minds of the audiences are stimulated almost just as quickly. So there we have the third element as the balance of entertaining and intellectual. And, you know, through my reading and almost all scholars point out, cabaret was this great artistic experiment, and its heyday didn't last long, and its very existence was unfortunately quite a struggle. And as I discussed when I was talking about the literary stages, balancing public taste, creative agency, and concerns about money, and concerns about censorship was really an uphill battle for this art form. To me, though, there's really no doubt in my mind that this experiment is truly worth recreating on today's stages. The repertoire to come from these stages is wholly unique, and it really does hold value for modern performers and audiences. So first, I'm going to talk about its value to classical singers. As a classical singer, I'm really familiar with the challenges of our instrument and our industry. I'm sure as many of you know, today in the arts, classical music endeavors are nearly all non-profit. And that's because they hold value for the public. And you know, as a classical singer, I feel a responsibility to deliver that value. And not only do I do so by looking to improve my skill set as an artist, but I also look to deliver creative programming that enlightens and engages. I look to have agency over every part of the artistic process because we are these leaders. And because of the classical singer, we are often trained exclusively in art song, oratorio, and opera. I really do find it necessary to look outside the realms of this traditional canon to really get true artistic freedom. Cabaret holds entirely different expectations for performers, and it doesn't ask you to complete fantastical vocal feats of agility, range, or breath control. It just asks you to deliver, without even any vocal pretenses, the text. And it asks you to deliver the text in an engaging and compelling manner. And there are common practices, but there aren't any rules. This art form hasn't been tainted by these, as we see in classical music, these sometimes arbitrary modes of tradition. There's just more freedom in this repertoire. And if you want to, if you wanted to yell a line of text in a song of cabaret, you could yell a line of text to make it pop out of this musical texture. And also, as the classical singers, we have somewhat of an advantage, I will say. We have more colors and vocal nuances at our disposal that most don't. And I think we can bring more to this genre than perhaps has ever been delivered. For instance, cabaret artists of the past that we hold truly in great regard may have spoken an entire song, but classical singers, we may choose to sing a verse and then speak one, and we have the ability to make it straight tone or add vibrato for emotional emphasis. Not to mention, we have this dynamic range that is unparalleled. We're trained to cut over orchestras without any amplification, so we can truly show that dynamic range in a cabaret song, and it can be super impactful. And as a classical singer, it's really a thrill to perform this repertoire that offers so much possibility. When I was directing my colleagues, I noticed this initial resistance to this newfound freedom, and it was a sort of inhibition that I saw in making these larger performative choices that were necessary to this genre. One of the artists was singing Tanzlied in music rehearsal, and this song, Tanzlied by Bogumil Zeppler, it is in the early days of cabaret. On the surface, it really did feel like traditional German Lieder. You know, both the vocal line when we looked at it and the piano accompaniment were in complete partnership, and it seemed to warrant a classical approach. But the text was about a teenage girl going out to dances for the first time, and it really showed us otherwise. It wasn't until blocking rehearsal, when I directed this cast member singing this to clumsily dance across the stage, that she just dropped all her inhibition and felt truthful. And as a director, it was my goal to foster those choices that she was making that were breaking classical conventions of art song delivery. She would sing directly to a member of the audience, which is not something we do in the delivery of an art song. Or she would take a seat to sing a few lines, which were these really exciting performative choices that we don't get to make as classical musicians, but also we don't get to see as audiences of classical music. And I really do think that modern audiences are not that different from audiences of the past. I know that's a bold statement, but those that consume art still do so for the same reasons: to feel connected, entertained, and challenged. So in short, people want to feel, enjoy, and think. And cabaret offers variety, intimacy, and accessibility. Scenes are digestible, they're thought-provoking, and audience inclusion is achieved right away because they break the fourth wall and there are small venue sizes. So in our production, The Wild Stage, I chose to preserve that short scene format and diverse mediums that are inherent in this genre. Variety really does engage the audience's ability to concentrate for longer. So I really was careful about making sure that our program in no way was too continuous and it didn't get monotonous. And I also kept the venue limited to a 50 to 100 seat capacity. The stage is not elevated above the audience, and the stage direction that I did really did include several points of contact with the audience members for each of the actors. And this intimacy really does allow the audience to feel included in the inner workings of this dramatic play that we're seeing on stage, which is so exciting. And in regards to accessibility, I had a difficult decision ahead of me, I have to say. Musically, many of these pieces include modern musical idioms. The songs are strophic, the refrain is sustained, lyrical, and hummable. And composers often enlist simple dance rhythms, but this harmonic language that we see is jazzy and the musical phrasing is singable. But my intention was to present this material to an audience of English speakers with English-speaking singers. The text is not in their vernacular, it's in German. And these works were often written with a Berlin dialect in mind, which adds a whole other layer. So today we see many artists performing these works in English and German. Udo Lemper's recording of Berlin cabaret songs was recorded in both languages. So I thought, shouldn't I be delivering these pieces in English? No, I thought no, because often these English translations that are fit into these pieces are designed to fit with the pre-existing vocal line, and they get rid of a lot of things. First of all, they eradicate the sardonic wit of the text, they blur poetic intentions, and then any onomatopoeia or alliteration you had within that text is gone. So, in short, really, the joke is lost. And even, I think, with English translations projected above the stage, even with an English-speaking audience that doesn't speak a word of German, I still think they get the joke better than if it was in an entirely different language. So in an effort, I also think that the Berlin dialect is often overlooked in modern recordings, and it offers this anchor of authenticity to the past. And in an effort to preserve that authenticity and an individuality within these texts, I really did choose to program all stage in their original German with direct idiomatic English translations projected above the stage. And then I had all the dialogue and spoken sketches in English translations. And I did this because they weren't beholden to musical structures. And I really did feel that this added, you know, that acceptable layer of accessibility. In today's world, I think we have a variety of artists making their mark on cabaret. The two people that immediately come to mind are Udo Lemper and Melinda Hughes. Both of these artists focus their work on recording and creating new and unique concert programs. And they're often self-directed, which is something extremely inspiring for me as a young classical singer that wants to have that kind of creative agency in their work. And when we look at somebody like Hughes, she really focuses heavily on adapting these works to reflect current political satires of this present day. And then Lemper focuses on delivering historically accurate yet personal and individual portrayals of these works. And I really want to focus on a balance of these two ideals. I think political and social relationships to the present day are actually often best realized when presented in the context of the past. As long as the context of the past is clearly established. And that's why also the texts haven't been modified to include modern references, and the minimal sets and costumes are reflective of 1920s Berlin. So our program ranges from 1900 to 1930 some. So I came together in the middle of the 20s, plus that's cabaret's heyday. When we take a look at some of the premiere programs of these various literary cabarets in Berlin, we sometimes see this lack of objective cohesion. Of course, they were inherently woven together by the fact that the music was written specifically for that particular evening on that particular stage. But these programs just often had these themes and sentiments that juxtaposed one another entirely. As I mentioned earlier, the Schallentrauch program, the premier program of the cabaret, had these highbrow scenes about Pierrot, that Commedia dell'arte character, in the song Abschied von der Bohème, for instance. But then it also had these songs written in dialect and colloquialisms about, again, this political and social strife that was facing the modern common man in Berlin. Like when we have Wenn der Automotive wieder takt. And because the modern audiences do not have the relevance to the here and now, no matter how much historic context I establish for them, and that would allow cohesion, I really decided to program repertoire with goals of thematic and character cohesion, which is somewhat contrary, but we also have to look at how we adapt these things. And I'm going to talk about my methodology for this programming of this concert, but I really want to offer the disclaimer that I often went out of order and repeated multiple steps within this process. Programming is truly a long and, if you'll allow me, messy process, and programming requires you to put works of art together into one representation. And from that one representation, we have these new artistic truths that will emerge throughout the process. So, my step-by-step process was as follows. Number one, enlist 5 colleagues of mine that are interested in this project. So for practical reasons, I started here. I would obviously, with this cast, I would have to look at songs that cater to each individual's vocal and dramatic strengths. And I knew them well because I work with these colleagues every day in our program at Roosevelt. And something I discovered about cabaret in my research was that most of these works were written for particular people to perform them. So as in pop music, songs are often identified with their performers, not their composers, which obviously this runs contrary to the classical music model, which holds the composer above all. So it only makes sense when programming a concert of cabaret to begin with these performers. So number two, look at prominent clubs and composers throughout the evolution of cabaret and look at what repertoire is available to me. I decided to include this sampling of repertoire. The early days of variety theater, the literary cabarets, and the stages of revue, I decided to include them all. Because the most prominent artists span at least 2 of these stages of the evolution of cabaret, I thought it was a much more manageable task to research the repertoire than I had previously thought. And because I began my research at the origins of cabaret, I did include a piece from the premiere of the Überbrettl, and then I looked at the literary cabarets, the heyday of cabaret, and I primarily included pieces written by Friedrich Hollander for the Schallentrauch. And then finally I looked to review, and I included pieces by Misha Spolansky and Willy Kollo. And these are selections by Willy Kollo that were made popular by Claire Waldoff, the performer I mentioned earlier. And thankfully, a great deal of Friedrich Hollander's music is in print, but I did have to get some help from Melinda Hughes, who's based out of Great Britain, when I was searching for selections by Misha Spolansky. She's in touch with his grandsons, and his grandsons were gracious enough to send me copies of pieces like Masculinum Feminum and Alles Schwindel. So, number three, we're moving on. Begin researching and uncovering the overall themes and messages of the selections. And obviously, this was perhaps the most ongoing and lengthy part of the research, and I had to at least begin this work on each and every song from the outset so that I could write this corresponding dialogue, I could determine the order of the program, and I could select corresponding sketches. And this process continued throughout the duration, and truly after all programming decisions were even made, too. And it still continues because you can always find more truth and more freedom within a piece. Step 4. As for sketches, I pulled largely from the Überbrettl stage because those were readily available. So I selected sketches that could set the scene or give further commentary on the song that would follow it. So if we take a look at The Lady is a Tramp, it precedes Ich bin ein Fump by Misha Spolansky. And while Ich bin ein Fump was written some 30 years later, pairing it with The Lady is a Tramp allowed these new meanings to shine through. It really, pairing them together actually made a comment on the evolution of women's rights at the time. Furthermore, it gave context to the singer taking center stage as the dramatic focus, and the sketch serves as a monologue for the singer to introduce herself. So I found that pairing these sketches with these songs went back to my original idea of programming as bringing works of art together to form one new piece of art that is this event that is separate from the work. Step 5, solidify the order of selections. So as I was researching and analyzing this repertoire, I began to notice these 3 distinct thematic or tone trends that I would choose to draw upon further by program order and dialogue. So the first was naivety, then rebellion, then nostalgia. And in the second lecture, I will talk about those 3 themes and how I fit each song into one of those 3 themes, or subsets, if you will. literary cabarets often had someone functioning as a conferencier that introduced each of the numbers or scenes. In other cases, and especially in revue, singing actors would have these monologues that were specifically tailored to the scenes or songs that they were presenting. And in many cases, these monologues are unfortunately lost, or there aren't any good translations, and that is something I'm not equipped to do at this point, quite yet. And as a result, I thought writing new dialogue would actually be my chance to make original thematic comments on this repertoire and weave these loose threads of narrative that gave the audience some sense of cohesion and give an actual illusion of spontaneity, as if these songs were actually occurring in real life out of thin air. For instance, after I rob this one character on stage, I actually steal her bracelet and then I announce it to the audience, and then I sing Alish Schwindel, which presents all these themes of immorality and greed, and I actually go on to accuse the audience of being greedy. I accuse everyone, and I'll talk more about that song in the second presentation as well. But that just gives you an idea that I was able to make an even bigger thematic comment because of the dialogue that I wrote. Not to mention, this dialogue really does serve to add more variety to the program. Audiences can really immediately grasp the context of the song because of the preceding dialogue. Not to mention, they are not lost in this world of unending sound that's typical in classical music and opera. This is something that really does differentiate the art form, and we really wanted to play to that. And, you know, as a classical musician, I really did feel the need to establish frameworks by which to analyze and present this genre. It was the musicologist in me. And while, you know, there are established methodologies for analyzing and performing bel canto operas, and because the composer is the ultimate authority on the work in classical music, you really must consider what is penned on the physical score primarily first in classical music. And then interpreters look to engage with the material in similar ways that performers have over the last 200 years. So in classical music, you look at the score and then you look at the historical interpretations. But standards like this don't really exist in cabaret. And while many of the scores are truly fully realized, they're not in the format of jazz charts, although some of them were, but that's another story. They're fully realized. They don't leave room for improvisation, really. There are still conventions that do allow for some improvisation or some choices beyond what you would be able to make in the score of a classical piece. For example, the vocal line is often written as doubled in the piano accompaniment, and sometimes we choose to omit this doubling. This decision to omit doubling is standard practice in jazz songs, but I would refer to it rather more of a choice than a rule. And in contrast to classical music, performers are the ultimate authority on these songs. In cabaret and other in popular music in general, the event is more important than the work, which is such an interesting differentiation. And from listening to primary source recordings and reading scholarly work, I really did find three major performance practice trends, not roles though. And many of these performance practice techniques I observed by listening to these original recordings, and thankfully we have these recordings. And you know, among them we have Paul Gratz singing Wenn der alte Mode wieder takt, and we also have Claire Waldoff singing Rausmitten Männern. And both of these singers use Sprechstimme throughout these pieces. My goal was really to identify when they did it and how they did it. And as I've stated before, no rule was emerging. However, I was able to notice that when the text was particularly dense or when the emotion changed, actors enlisted Sprechstimme. So when they had this dense line of text that would be hard to sustain a lyrical line on, they would resort to speaking. Or when the emotion was totally different from what had preceded it, they would change the color by speaking it. And there use of Sprechstimme really did in no way depend on what was musically notated within the score. I didn't notice any melodic or rhythmic trends with Sprechstimme, and certainly it wasn't notated like Sprechstimme. It was notated like a vocal line of melody. I also noticed that their inflection varied a great deal more than in speech. So it wasn't speech, it was Sprechstimme, but still the line wasn't melodic or sustained. So often I would direct cast members to use Sprechstimme when text was repeated. So again, when there's an emotional shift. And they were often challenged to sing it one time through and then speak it the next because things were semi-strophic. Or I directed them to use it in these really dense political couplets where we have these references that we really need to hear very clearly. The repertoire that we have programmed was performed by Berliners for Berlin audiences back then. And it was meant to appeal to the masses, so it's only logical for this native dialect to be incorporated into texts. When I was first viewing the scores of several compositions, elements of dialects are actually in place in the writing. And at first I thought certain words were errors in printing. But after so many were reappearing, I thought I had better consult a linguistic expert. So first I reached out to Professor Michael Latham here at Roosevelt. Thank you, Professor Latham. And he helped me with several translations. And he pointed out that many of my confusions actually centered around dialect. I couldn't believe it. So from there I listened to many of the recordings, and they revealed that the dialect appeared throughout compositions that didn't actually bear any colloquialisms within the scores. So even when the dialogue wasn't physically penned on the score, these actors were interpreting it and adding it themselves. So that's when I knew that I needed to consult the Goethe Institute in Chicago. Luckily, Julia Artusia, thank you, Julia, at the Goethe Institute was a Berlin native, and she was able to offer us a coaching. And not only did each of us gain a new understanding of how to sing in the dialect and actually how to form those sounds in our mouth, but we also knew when to implement. The dialogue would turn out to be largely individual. And as with any dialect, it comes in varying degrees. As someone who speaks in a regional dialect myself, the way I just speak, you know, really depends on my emotions. And the fact that some words I have adopted fully into my vocabulary and some are just absent from my native dialect. And from this discovery, I directed each of the cast members to, you know, incorporate the dialect, but to do so in a way that felt true and natural for them. And in case you're interested in what dialect sounds like, we'll have some examples up on the Instagram page soon so that you can really hear the difference. And I also recently did a live interview with Lizzie Schroeder that will be up on the feed soon, and she talks about when she chose to use the dialect and when she didn't choose to use it. And now I'm going to touch on the third performance practice. So first we had Sprechstimme, then we had dialect, and now we have sardonic wit and breaking the fourth wall. And for those of you that don't know, breaking the fourth wall simply means addressing the audience. It's the awareness that the audience is even there. And as classical music performers, with the exception of, you know, opera buffo, we're generally trained to avoid breaking the fourth wall at all costs and to maintain this gravity of the situation. In cabaret, however, the sardonic wit and direct contact with the audience is actually essential. And not only does it increase the intimacy of the occasion, but it also allows performers to elicit humor in a way that doesn't depend on emotional or physical slapstick. Many of these texts are parodies, and parody, especially when dealing with subjects far removed from here or now, is really difficult for audience to grasp without sardonic wit. In parody, the sarcasm and sardonic wit has to be really present. And additionally, there are these critical accounts of Paul Gratz in performances, that's what really pointed me to this, that describe a wink or an eye roll to the audience during these seemingly serious moments because it was parody. And obviously, performers were using sardonic wit as a tool. And this dramatic coaching would have been some of the final touches to our performance, this coaching of me, you know, encouraging people to use this wit. But the blocking was already set to include frequent audience contact and like a constant awareness of their presence. And an example of this is when one character enters singing Vedra Altamoda Vida Takht, my character acts annoyed to see him, and I'm visibly so, and I engage the audience in this annoyance. I would have even went further in that moment to look directly at the audience and maybe roll my eyes or like say or mouth to an audience member, is this real right now? Some humorous moment like that that really pulls them in and engages them and makes them feel included, but also makes it apparent that I am not in this situation. I'm actually commenting on it. So when the cast and I left Roosevelt for spring break, we had just completed music rehearsals and begun blocking scenes. So we already began to incorporate these three performance practices, but I did not have the opportunity to work with all of the actors on blocking. We did have musical coachings though. And I mentioned earlier across the board, I seemed to notice this initial resistance to this newfound freedom from classical idioms. But soon after that process began, these actors were really beginning to unleash their instincts. And of course, it's my hope that from the performance, these actors would have seen this importance of connecting with their audience and connecting in a way that they didn't think was possible. There's really great power in tuning into the energy of an audience. And I think classical musicians would really do well to implement that process into the art they create in classical spheres. I think, and not for all classical musicians, and I think we're striving to do so, but the puzzle piece that's so often missing is listening instead of performing. And I think cabaret just does such a wonderful job of listening as part of our performance. And, you know, while it may never be appropriate to or possible to use Sprechstimme in a Verdi aria, something so accessible as the register of speech, maybe it would be appropriate to physicalize in an art song in a way that demonstrates meaning, in a way that we did in Tanzlied. You know, maybe that would be a great way to interpret art song. And I think we can really take a lot from cabaret and its practice and what it offers to an audience. So that is all for this lecture. I really appreciate you listening and being here with me. And I, again, would like to point your attention to our Instagram page at The Wild Stage. And if you have any further questions, please feel free to email me. My email is bcollins@mail.roosevelt.edu. I would love to hear from you if you're interested in this project or have further questions for me, or if for some reason you don't have an Instagram account and you would love access to some of this extra content that I can offer. I would love to hear from you. So I hope you have a wonderful day, evening. Goodbye.